rather more commonly. All I'm really interested in is that you have some concept of the movement of history. Now, if you went to well, of course, I wish we had time to offer my curriculum to people a course in Western civilization where you just sort of get the sweep of things. But what I want you to understand is, if you look back at the world of ancient world, ancient history. What marks the line between prehistory, what is the prehistoric period, and the historical period? Okay, written records. That's the difference. Okay? There are artifacts all the way back, but written records. And if there are roughly the period between 3000 BC and 2000 BC, civilizations grew up in the Mesopotamian River Valley, in the Nile River Valley. There's another one which I did not go into, but I just mentioned here in passing. If you go around the Indian Ocean, the Persian Gulf into the Indian Ocean, down here, or in this area down here, into northern India, this map continued, there was a civilization which was also, which was contemporary with the ancient civilization we talked about in the period 3000 to 2000, called the Indus River Valley Civilization. We know a great civilization flourished, we know it was highly developed. INDUF, Indus River, is called that because nobody knows what it was. For instance, one of the ways we know that they was a highly developed civilization was that they built cities on the same pattern, and these cities were as much as 300 miles apart. But the river, when the waters rose, what would happen in that valley? Apparently, yes, as the waters rose, people gradually moved out. Possibly, as these waters rose, swamps were created and became malarial. People could not live there anymore because of mosquitoes. We don't know exactly, but we don't know what happened to them. We know they had a system of varieties, but it's all gone. The one thing that has survived are a few seals to work with, but nobody knows what language they used. But we know they must have had a highly developed man. It was a highly developed civilization, but it's just gone. So you've heard of it before? And it's Indus River Valley Civilization, but yet nobody knows anything about it. Okay, and so the three great riverine civilizations, call that because they're from the river valley, the Nile, the Mesopotamian Valley, Indus River. And there is some evidence that in certain areas in the north, civilization developed much earlier than we thought. It hadn't been thought, but that's still an unopened book. Roughly about the year 2000 BC, there was a great shuffling about, a breakdown of civilization, a very brief dark age, because of pressure from the north, barbaric people from the north who couldn't crush in. And so Egypt went into a decline. We pointed out that by the year 2000 BC, the time of building the Great Pyramid was over. The Sumerian civilization was gone. And then after a period of 1500 years, it developed again in this valley. There was somewhat of a revival of Egypt. The Neo-Babylonian Empire, Hammurabi, we read the quote of the Law of Hammurabi, the Gilgamesh epic. I read some of the story, the Babylonian story of the flood. Yeah. It's called the Old Babylonian Empire in this area. Roughly between the year what flourished at 1800 BC down to 1550, roughly, these very round numbers. And during this, and then after this period, during this period, civilization developed in the Crete, the Minoan civilization. But then around the year 1000 again, barbarians are very helpful as history students. About 1,000 years later, there was another shuffling. Sea peoples the sea peoples in ancient documents. Great reshuffling again, another dark age, where writing, between the year 1000 and about 750 BC, writing existed only one place in the world, as far as you know, which is where? In Palestine. No written records from the ancient Minoan and Mycenaean civilizations down to the archaic Greek period, and it was a dark age again. And then at the beginning of the revive, we have the Assyrian Empire being developed, and around 800 BC, 700 BC, and Assyria gradually gained control of this area, and it was the Assyrians who took the northern kingdom when it fell, 722 BC. And then in 612, the capital of Syria, Nineveh, fell to the rising Babylonian, or sometimes called the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Nebuchadnezzar, this is the one in the book of Daniel, put the Hebrew children in the fiery furnace. Called Neo-Babylonian because the old Babylonian, or the old Amorite kingdom of Hammurabi, is called the old Babylonian Empire. And so that never happened in the period of the prophets. And the Babylonian Empire lasted from roughly, well, it destroyed the capital of the Assyrian Empire in 612 BC. It itself fell. It destroyed the temple. Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple in 586, 587 BC.
And in 538 B.C., the Persians, under Cyrus, destroyed Babylon, the famous fall of Babylon, which is described in or in reference to in the book of Daniel. Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar's feast, the handwriting on the wall. That night, Cyrus took Babylon. And this is also the care I pointed out that this was the classical age of Greece, the age of the Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Salamis, the Battle of Thermopylae, this part which has been romanticized and glorified by the Greek epic chorus. And it's when Persia tried to push its way into Europe. The main thing that kept the Persians out of Europe, which would have greatly affected our history, by the way, they don't have time to go into. The main thing that kept the Persians out of Europe from taking Greece was the weather. On two occasions, the Persian fleet, the Phoenicians had hired, were destroyed, and their supplies were cut by storms. Weather did more harm. What I'm saying is, during this period, they were fighting for about 30 years. The weather did more harm to the Persians than the Greeks ever thought of them. And, in fact, Xerxes, the second rise of Xerxes won. He built a pontoon bridge across the Hellespont here. A bunch of gold ships, put them, line them up, and build a ramp across them. Get his troops and supply. He wanted to stay on land as much as possible. He learned his lesson from Darius, who had lost everything in a storm off of Athens, which is right here. And he was going to try to keep everything on land that he could. And a storm came up, and he started pontoon bridge. And the very idea of the weather, of the Hellespont, the sea, confusing his plans, he ordered that the Hellespont be beaten with chains, and they did. They went out and spanked the Hellespont. I'd like to have been there and seen that. Told you 100 times. What he did, he had the Hellespont beaten with chains, destroying the pontoon bridge. But anyway, the Persian Empire, this brings it to the close of the Old Testament period. The Persian Empire stood, Persepolis was destroyed about the year 330 years before Christ, roughly, when he was there 2 years. Alexander came to this part of the world in 332. He went east, went into northern India, and took his companion, sailed down the river, and came back up this way. He died in Babylon. Alexander the Great died in 323 B.C. When he died, this is where we are to now. Let me just say it again to get it in our mind. Here, the 3000 B.C. and the 2000 B.C., the old Mesopotamian, Sumerian, Sargonid, Neo-Sumerian civilizations here, the old kingdom period, 2700-2900 B.C. in Egypt. Then they sort of a breakdown. Then a revival. The revival was the old Babylonian Empire of Hammurabi, which eventually fell. When other invasions around 1200 B.C., another breakdown. Civilization revived again, and it continues this time. By the way, I want you to see this. When the church was established, the church was established in the declining years of the third millennium of civilization. Civilization was old. The world was old. Ideas were old. People were tired when the church was established. And so, in this third period, the Assyrians, down to about 612, then the Neo-Babylonians, the Nebuchadnezzar, his successors, here's the prophet, 538 Babylon fell to the Persians, and 332 Persepolis fell to Alexander the Great. Each empire was replaced by another. And when Alexander the Great died, Alexander the Great established all over the world a Greek city-state, that is, a functioning city, and thus introduced Greek culture. This is why, as I said last week, the New Testament was written in Greek, because Greek became a universal international language. Now, Alexander the Great died. His generals, there was no strong rule from back up in Macedonia. So his generals proceeded to divide up the world like a pie, and to fight over it. And when the dust settled, you had two major, I won't go into this, but when the dust settled, you had two major factions which were important to the world of the Old Testament. There were the Ptolemies in Egypt, represented by the pink here. And this map showed the earlier period when the Ptolemies controlled the land of the Holy Land, we would call Palestine, most of it. the year 200 BC and shortly thereafter, the Seleucids, or kind of the yellow, they won out and they controlled this period. They, in other words, we go after about 200 BC, well, probably down to 180, really, BC, I'm using round numbers. This would be yellow, y'all see that? They, and so, this is the period when Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid, the Ptolemies, this Ptolemy was one of Alexander's generals, and so he ended up establishing a military rule over Egypt in this area. Got that? And his descendants are called the Ptolemies. Cleopatra was one of them. The Seleucids was another general of Alexander the Great. He ended up in this part of the world. And he and his descendants are called the Seleucids. Got that?
No.
There were simply descendants named for this general who was alive, we would call it general. And Alexander the Great died. Now, and so there was no one great power in the world. There was sort of a balance of power between the West and the East. And there was some of the details going on here, which I won't go into now. When Antiochus Epiphanes was in 165 BC, 168 BC, he's the one who desecrated the temple by offering a pig on the altar. First instance of a genuine religious persecution in the history of the world. He made it illegal to be a Jew, illegal to worship the God of Israel. Always before, they had said you can worship wherever you want to as long as you worship our God. But now they said you cannot worship your gods. So it resulted in the overthrow of the Seleucids under the famous Maccabeans, Judas Maccabeus, Judas the Hammer, who was the first one ever to use guerrilla warfare. He used the Judean hilt in advantage of small, lightly armed, fast-moving force, hit and run and hide. And eventually they forced the Seleucids into a compromise, so there was about 100 years of freedom. Now the Seleucids still had ruling on paper, but the Maccabeans had worked out a Mexican standoff, so there was limited freedom. And then, this was about 165 BC, then about roughly 65 BC, 100 years later, rather than round numbers, Rome asserts itself in this part of the world. And this was really the eastern border of the Roman Empire. The Romans, on a couple of occasions, especially after Christ, they tried to rule the kingdom of the ancient Persians. These were Parthians, the descendants of the ancient Persians, but they never could do it. They claimed that they never did do it. The Parthians, for instance, Rome was too far away from home. The Parthians had, in this flat country, they had their cavalry. The Roman army, the cavalry, was a backup force to the infantry. But most of the land in this part of the world was rocky, mountainous, narrow valleys. For cavalry or chariot warfare to be effective, you've got to have a wide open plain. And therefore, the Roman army was equipped to fight in mountainous, rough terrain. They had their legions, and they were highly trained, and they could take about anybody except. And they didn't know the land. So far away, the supply lines were stretched out. They didn't have a good map. Didn't know the country. They were at the mercy of the enemy, and the enemy with their superior cavalry could simply hit and run and stomp them a little bit, and then go behind the next hill and never be seen again. The Romans did win some wars and some battles, but what I'm saying is, I'm spending too much time on it, that the land of the Bible actually became, for all practical purposes, became the eastern border of the Roman Empire. You got that? They claimed various times before, but they never actually ruled it. But the Roman Empire, the Romans established their presence here roughly 60 years before Christ. Now they had, and this was the eastern border of the Roman Empire for all practices. As part of the empire actually functioned. They never really ruled over in this part of the world. They had some successful military campaigns, but they never could maintain it. For instance, Hadrian, when he came after the time of Christ, after the first century, Hadrian, when he came to the throne, the first thing he did was draw the borders in. Why? Doesn't it get to claim a border you can't defend? He lose a lot of men, a lot of money, but he tightened up the borders. Anyway, okay, now the Roman Empire developed. Now again, this is very brief. Then what's the help was? The Roman Empire developed this way. Rome's not even on this map. But Rome is definitely here.
And Rome started out as a very powerful city-state. It was Rome. The thing that made Rome so powerful was, interesting, and I think this is very instructive, the thing that made Rome so powerful, or the single thing was, is that they had a strong conception of authority, law, obedience, and family. The teacher of a Roman boy was his father. And a Roman, whereas the Greeks would exercise for the beauty of their body, for the joy of athletic competition, the Romans were very utilitarian. They exercised, trained only to be good soldiers, and to have healthy bodies to work. They learned just enough math to do business. They didn't write poetry. They were businessmen, and they were taught, and the sons learned everything at their father's elbow, learned how to, you know, run the business world, how to run the home, how to fight, and they were taught unquestioned obedience. The Roman father had the right to put his son to death at any time he wanted to. Not recourse, the law had nothing to say about it. And I don't care if the son was 50 years old. As long as his father was alive, you could say the word, have him put to death. It didn't happen very often, but they could do it. Absolute authority. So what you had were a lot of people who, they had high morals. Homosexuality was unheard of among the ancient Romans. Whereas in the ancient Greeks, it was a way of life. The Greeks never amounted a whole lot militarily because they couldn't quit fighting each other, like the modern Arabs. The Arabs never quit fighting each other. Israel's in a lot of trouble, but they never will. And the Greeks never could quit fighting each other long enough. The thing that made Alexander the Great, he was such a charismatic character, so brave and bold, so he appealed to the Greeks. They'd follow him anywhere. But note that before Alexander the Great conquered the world, he first had to conquer Greece. He had to conquer his own people. When he destroyed, for instance, the ancient city of Thebes, he leveled every house in the city except the house of Pindar, the poet. He respected him, so left his house standing. So he had to conquer the other Greek-speaking peoples before he could conquer the rest of the world. But the Romans weren't like that. The Romans knew how to run the world. This heritage went back very far. First, the Romans were the only ones really administered the world the way the ancient Persians had. They knew how to set up a system. The Romans had built several million miles of roads. The Romans had the postal system. The Romans had international monetary system. Businessmen, administrators, and they were excellent soldiers, the ancient Roman legion, because they were so obedient. You get 10 guys, no matter how good they are, like a basketball team, you get 5 guys. They can really be good players, if every one of them star. If they don't do what the coach says, they're going to compete. Not a good team. If you take 5 mediocre players, they'll do exactly what they're told. They can beat a good team. That's what happens. Well, the Romans brought it. Anyway, the Romans started out. And their first war was defensive. They were attacking other people, and the Romans were business-like, the ancient people on the Italian peninsula, first of all, they couldn't see any reason to simply, you know, these people would try to put through, it was a way of life, you know, the city-state got strong, they would try to control, conquer, raid, loot, put down any other city-state. They couldn't see any reason to fight the same battle year after year. So then what they did, they established what we call martial law. We're going to defeat them again next year, or 2 years later. They enlarged their borders. And another enemy would threaten them, and they would simply end up, you know, once they defeated them, they were going to just, you know, leave them alone to rebuild their forces. They administered them, ruled them, protect themselves. Finally, the greatest enemy was the Carthaginians, who were the descendants of the ancient Phoenicians. This is the famous Hannibal, famous Punic Wars. And he came across through Spain and the Dolphins. And so as soon as the Romans conquered him, they ended up administrating Northern Africa, that part of Northern Africa. Then over in Greece, Pyrrhus came over and tried to do the Romans in, you know, and he won a victory, which he lost about 8/10 of his men. He's the one who said, "One more victory like this, and I'm done for." It's a Pyrrhic victory. You know, a Pyrrhic victory is a victory that costs you more than it's worth. And this is so the Romans ended up administering Greece, you know. And they still didn't have an empire, but they didn't have the dividend. And what had
had happened was, and this is, by the way, it's important New Testament study. What had happened to the Romans was this. I'm summarizing and capitalizing this. So I hope you, I'm saying enough to get the general picture. The Roman Republic was ruled by the Senate. And he said, well, here's basically the way it worked, and I wish I had more time to put this, but the Senate worked like this. There were the old families of Rome, this old aristocracy. There are many of them. Ones who had raised in the old traditions. You want to read somebody who's decrying the decline of the old traditions in the century before Christ, read Cicero.
Perhaps it was called the greatest, most famous Roman in Julius Caesar. But these old families were set up like this, that a son was raised, and he was expected. His public wasn't paid for. He was expected as part of his service. When he got so, he was expected to spend so many years in the army. Now, note that he was an officer. He was trained for it. Most of them were pretty good. Some were lousy. But most of them were pretty good. The non-citizens. By the way, as these wars fought, they had more and more slaves. We're going to talk about slavery. The non-citizens were the cannon fodder. But these men were considered, probably they had to serve in the army so many years. Several years. And then it was expected to serve in the government for so many years. Use their experience. And they would be elected as consuls. But no, only a consul, very security. Only for a short period. It was a system of don't let one man, you know, power corrupts, therefore. These consuls would rule for a couple of years, then they would step down. So others would take their place, revolving. The rules according to the law. We have roughly the same thing, don't we? We find, for instance, the corruption in Washington. Have you seen it? The corruption in Washington, we've seen the last 10 years, they've exploded in the last 10 years. Most of it has been by men who have been in the Senate or in the House for 20 or 30 years. The old timers. The Roman solution was that, and was get him out. Now, there was a lot of corruption, don't get me wrong. This is the way the system, the old republic. Well, the problem was that there weren't enough of them to go around to rule the world. The governors were called for proconsul. That is, a man served as he had done his time in the army, and then he had served, been elected to the consulship, and many various periods, and served one time, served a couple of years. Then, from these proconsuls that had been consuls before, or pro means, been consuls before, these became the governors. And the governor would go out, Pilate was one of them. Oh, by Pilate's time, they began to have to use people who were not the old aristocracy, the governors. From the next class down, which were the equestrians. We're going to talk about them later, but they begin to have to use, they just weren't enough of them to go around. And the older families, they became corrupt for having fewer and fewer children, too. And we'll come back to that. But they would, so a man, he's mine. Now, there was a lot of variations on this, a lot of exceptions. But basically, here was the idea. A man would serve as the empire, you know, as the republic grew, man would serve, he would be raised in an aristocratic family, the old Roman, pure Roman. And he became an increasing minority in his own empire. And he would serve in the military for so many years as an officer. And he would serve ideally in the government. He might be various grades in that. He would work himself up to a consul. Became a consul. Then, from these men who had served consuls, who were already older men, Cicero was, by the way, the counselor of opinion, as was one of the famous letters written about Christian persecution. Pliny the Younger was a governor of Bithynia as well. They were serving a short period of time. But these proconsuls would be the men who would be sent to be governors of the provinces, ideally. Experienced men. They would serve most 3 years. But of course, well, there was a lot of corruption. In fact, in the time of Christ, the Romans had a joke they told, which was based on fact, really, that a man needed to be governor for 3 years. He needed to be governor the first year to make enough money from corruption and graft to pay for what it costs to bribe the Senate to get in the office. cost about a year's graft to get the job. Then, the second year, he could do the graft and pray he could get rich and not get enough to retire on. He needed one more year because the third year he had to get enough money to bribe the judges because they had a law that the governor, you know, mishandled his office, he was corrupt, so I didn't like him, they could bring him to trial, and they could take his life. But only after he was out of office. You couldn't bring a governor to trial while he was in office. And so he'd been corrupt for 2 years, wanted to get enough money to buy the office, second year enough money to retire on.
He knew he was going to face the trial, so he didn't have to make enough money the third year to bribe the judges. Well, it was not true in that. That was just the system. What it told.
It gives you some indication of how things were.
Now, these Romans became more and more a minority in their own people. But basically what happened was, why did they become an empire? Well, the Roman Republic, and this is a gross oversimplification, but the old Republic, where the sons of the aristocracy would come up through the ranks, be trained in business, be trained in military, be trained in government, and this, and they were expected to render public service, they were paid for this. They were paid sometime for some of the different ranks in the army, but most of them were serving in the government, the Senate, whatever, they were not paid. But this system was fine when Rome was a city-state on the Italian peninsula. But it simply did not work when they had an empire. Would not work. Romans became the victims of their own success. Nobody could beat the Roman army, not very often. The Roman legion was a deadly thing. But see, the Roman legion originally was made up of all Roman citizens. All these sons that had even been raised to disobedience and braiding. Well, and as the system broke, and so by the time of the century before Christ, chaos had set in. The government was breaking down. The money, inflation was rampant. And by this time, again, now the Romans, you got this? The Romans had overthrown the Seleucids had crumbled, and Seleucid Empire, and the Romans asserted themselves, and this became the Roman Empire. But in the century before Christ, things were in chaos. Inflation had destroyed the value of the money. There was corruption, and the old aristocratic system was shot through with corruption. They had, the Romans, for instance, in Rome itself, had won so many slaves. Well, not just Rome, throughout the empire. They won so many slaves through their military success that the Roman citizens did not work anymore. And Rome, for instance, was full of, the time of Christ, Rome had a complete welfare state. Because it was full of citizens who, for all kinds of reasons, mainly because of economic disaster, were poor. They were citizens of Rome, but they had no money. Many times slaves are better off. One of the things Augustus did, we're going to mention this again, he limited the dole, that is, the dole was the daily ration of bread, to 200,000 in the city of Rome. There were a lot more of them than that. It's a big welfare state. And we see the same thing in Great Britain. See, in Great Britain, according to law, nobody has anything to worry about. It's a socialism. That if you're sick, take care of you medically. If you're hungry, there's somebody to feed you. The state assumes responsibility for your life. And of course, it didn't have to happen in America. It affected the complete moral disintegration of people. And it happened in Rome. And so things were in a chaos. Kind of condition. And it was ripe for what has happened time and time again in history. It was ripe for a dictatorship. A man to come along and say, look, put the power in me and I'll lead us on to glory. I'll solve the problems. And so Rome went from a rule by law, in actual fact, to a rule by a dictator. The first of these, who really became powerful and asserted his control, was Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar, what he did was, the Gauls of this part of the world over here, the Gauls had ruled, who were the ancestors of the French, Caesar had an army, and Caesar was a great military leader. They took second in Latin, probably had to read Caesar's Gallic Wars. This is the century before Christ. This is all here. Caesar did what some had done before, but he did it more successfully. He had an army, and he was successful. And so he thought, well, the Romans had a law, an ancient law, that a general could not enter Italy at the command of his own army. He fought, you know, in a foreign war, we would call it. He had to get up the route before he came home. And because they learned that from the fact of life that these men had an army in them. Well, the army was, in a way that we could not understand, was personally loyal to the general. The first loyalty was to him. He's the one that saw they got paid. The Senate would never pay the soldiers during this period. They don't promise them much, give them nothing. Only if they were successful in war did the general see that they got paid. Therefore, the first alliance was to him, so the allegiance was to him. Therefore, the Romans knew that these generals had a common way. They had a successful campaign to come home and try to make themselves rulers of Rome because they had the army. That's what Caesar did. He had an army, and famous, he crossed the Rubicon, a little incident in the creek that was the northern bound of Italy. Remember, you heard he crossed the Rubicon, you committed yourself. What he did was, as soon as Caesar came back from the Gallic Wars and crossed this little creek called the Rubicon, as soon as he crossed it, the head of his army, he became an outlaw. He broke the Roman law. He was a revolutionary. And the Senate would immediately raise an army to destroy him. And this is where he said, you know, this famous, the die is cast. You heard that? The die is cast. A die is single for dice. And what he meant was, he was gambling everything. As soon as he crossed the Rubicon, he had put everything he owned on the line. Don't die. If he won, he would be dictator of Rome. If he lost, he'd be killed. And so he came down. As a matter of fact, Caesar established himself as the ruler in Rome. The Senate was a rubber stamp organization. And by the way, those who killed, you ever read, first the most famous in your contact with Caesar, probably Julius, probably Shakespeare, Caesar. But there is truth in Shakespeare. That is, when those Brutus and Cassius and that crowd kill Caesar and Pompey, they love Caesar. They really did. Nothing personal in that. They didn't hate him. They respected him, admired him. You see, they recognized what he had done. That the Roman system of government, you know, it would be like us maybe sanctioning the assassination of the trial or jailing of someone who would threaten to overthrow a constitutional government. They recognized that Rome, what they know, was done for us. Not because he was not a good man, he was a great man, but because, and Caesar loved Rome. Interesting. See, often Caesar was presented as a tyrant who came in to make Rome his puppet, you know. It wasn't that way at all. Caesar loved Rome. Caesar was trying to save Rome. Well, things were terrible in Rome. The world was falling apart. He was going to establish the old virtues, the old traditions, the old strength of character in ancient Rome. He was going to establish the ancient traditions. But you see, his enemies realized that he destroyed everything he was going to establish by destroying constitutional law. So they assassinated him. And this brings us to Augustus Caesar in the Augustan age. Now, look at our outline. Oh, by the way, look at Roman numeral 11 on this outline, the last page of this outline. The Roman Republic was established in 509, and, Roman numeral 11, right? Roman Empire, 27 to 8400. 27 BC, this is what we're going to come into in the next lecture, so I'll just mention here. Augustus establishes the Principate, we'll talk about how he did that. And then the first century was the age of Christ in the early church. Then we had the continuing gradual decline of Rome, and Rome persecuting the church in the second and third centuries, and then Rome becoming a so-called Christian center of Constantine in the fourth century, and Rome was gone. When did Rome fall? See, you cannot say when Rome fell. Technically, in about AD 457, I believe is the year, Romulus Augustus, the last official emperor of Rome, was kidnapped by the Germans. So technically, that was the Roman Empire. However, the difficult thing is that no empire replaced Rome. For instance, what's the most famous book, the early series, on the decline of the Roman Empire, of course, is that by Guinness.
and given in the story of the fall of the Roman Empire in AD 1453, fall of Constantinople. 1,000 years after the last official emperor stood. When did it fall? When was it wrong? Some claim the Roman Empire was continued through the Holy Roman Empire of Charlemagne, what he claimed to do. You cannot put your finger on and say, this is when Rome fell. Rome did not fall, really. Rome sort of crumbled and... Okay. Think of Rome. Remember the movie? The most funniest thing I ever did. Remember Gunga Din? It was a comedy movie, an old movie. You heard this famous Kipling poem. What? I fell to you and blazed you by the living God who made you. You're a better man than I am, Gunga Din. British India in the 19th century. Anyway, I heard the movie one time. In this movie, Gunga Din was this Navy man who saved the British regiment to hit. And in this story, he stood on top of the hill. It wasn't a comedy movie. Anyway, in the real movie, he stood on top of the hill and he warned the British when the rebels were coming, the Indian rebels. And he stood there and blew the trumpet, and they're firing at him. He's wounded, he blows it again, they're firing at him, you know. And I heard a comedy album one time, and I had to go again. And you'd hear this, he'd blow his trumpet, and then you'd hear, why, you know, the cannon fire. Well, he's dead. He'd blow it again, when he's in a week or, you know. And then you'd hear all this cannon fire, you know. Finally, about six times, you know, you just hear this tremendous explosion go on for about a whole minute. And, Rome was like that. The decentralized and disorganized people to the north would raid Rome and sack Rome and throw a wrench into Rome all of a sudden. Rome would revive itself a little bit. So, you see, we could say, well, the Assyrian Empire ended 612 when the capital fell and the Babylonians took over. You got that? And the Babylon Empire ended in 538 when Babylon fell and the Persians took over. And the Persian Empire fell in 332 when Persepolis fell and Alexander took over. And but you can't do it wrong. Because nobody took over. Like in Europe into the Dark Ages. Because there was nobody to take over. There was no high civilization to take its place. And so you had to get dark and like you can read or write. It's very ignorant. So that's Rome. Now I was reading a sweep of the Roman Empire. Now we come to the period that concerns us, and I begin to focus in and look at the new outline I've given you. You have me away when I want magic wand, actually. I get some coffee. Let's look at our new outline. And we look at the Age of Augustus. Now, I think your reading assignment is on there. The Age of Augustus. Maybe those left over somewhere. Now, your reading assignment is here. We're talking about the rise of Augustus. Again this morning. Well, this is where we go. Augustus, remember I said that Julius Caesar had tried to save Rome, and those who killed him didn't hate him. They were trying to save Rome too from Julius Caesar. And when Julius Caesar died, it entered a period of what we would call civil war. Now, first of all, let's talk about the rise of Augustus. In 44 BC, Julius Caesar was assassinated. And Mark Antony thought that he would inherit the throne. Really, he thought, well, he would take over, but he would grant the Senate constitutional rule, and he would not be as bad. And Caesar had a grand nephew by the name of Caius Octavius, right at the name of the Lord, because this is Augustus. And Caius Octavius was he became the defender of the memory of his uncle, of his great uncle, Julius Caesar. He raised an army. Keep in mind, remember, you say, well, how can these men raise an army? Well, you see, there was no central rule. Things were breaking down. There's military dictatorships.
The men, their primary allegiance was to their general. These men had a lot of money, and they raised an army, and they began to fight one another. Really, what they were doing was, they were fighting for the privilege of saving Rome. Almost destroyed in the process, you know, they were fighting for the privilege of doing what Julius Caesar would do, basically. They thought they knew best who could put Rome back together. The Republic was dead. You got that? Except the government had crumbled. It would not work.
Why was Mark Antony? What was he that he should?
He was a part of the in crowd. He was one of the ruling aristocracy. He was one who was in on the assassination of Caesar. Although, not really. He was not directly involved, but he was a part of this palace intrigue, you could call it. Very confusing. Mark Antony assumed command of Julius Caesar's army. And Brutus, who was, one of the assassins, he claimed, he thought he would set himself, he said, well, I'll take over this part of the empire, Cisalpine Gaul, that means Gaul, the part of Gaul on the other side of the Alps. And I'll take over that part of the world and straighten things out there. But Caesar's grandnephew was not going to put up with this. And so he raised an army of his own. They began to fight one another. Caius Octavius, who became Augustus, he won a battle with Mark Antony at a place called Mutina. Don't worry about that. And the Senate voted in the second triumvirate, that is, the three-man rule. Caius, the first one had been Caesar, Pompey, and Cassius. The second triumvirate was, don't worry about that, was Caius, who became Caesar Augustus, Mark Antony, the famous Mark Antony, who made a quippy with Cleopatra, and a third one, who don't worry about because he didn't count very much, called Lepidus, L-E-P-I-D-U-S. But now we had, fourth thing I want you to see is that after the death of Julius Caesar, when the dust settled, there arose a twofold power struggle between Mark Antony and Caius Octavius. Mark Antony taking over Julius Caesar's army, Caius Octavius had raised his own army. You got this? What they were trying to do was establish a ruling Rome that would put things back together. Now, and they begin to fight. These, first of all, but however, the Senate saw that they were fighting, and so the Senate made them a committee, a triumvirate, these two plus a third man. Now, what these men did was, they agreed to work together, but only, and let me unsaid this, but this is what it was, only until they got things straightened out in Rome, until they could get things squared away, as we would say, enough, they could begin fighting each other seriously. In other words, it's obvious that, okay, we'll work together. Till we get Rome, till we get things straightened out. And then we'll settle who's going to be in charge. And so they did. They realized that Rome was shot through with corruption. And it was. And so they, first of all, begin what military dictatorships always do, they begin a purge. Get rid of all the ruling factions who had caused all the problems. Only they were very generous with their proscription lists, and they thought the more the merrier, and they got a lot who weren't guilty. And according to Suetonius, the ancient Greek, ancient Roman historian, 300 senators were put to death. I got this by this. These three men working together, this military dictatorship, with 300 senators to death and 2,000 what we would call businessmen. That kind of thing done in Cambodia, by the way, you get rid of the leaders and start again. With the natural leaders of the people. Now, a lot of these businessmen were rich, and they left widows, and so they forced these widows to give their fortunes to the dictatorship, to the triumvirate. A lot of money. And in this purge, it was so bad that almost anybody who was accused of anything would be assumed to be guilty. Many slaves got rid of their harsh masters at this period. They were sent to report them as being disloyal to the state or corrupt. They take the old boy out and string him up. And I'm teaching to make me work too hard. And however many slaves at this period were, Suetonius tells about one slave who took Well, they were did it coming on these days. They were hanging. They were decapitating. Remember, Rome, Paul, tradition has Paul being decapitated. Because if you're a Roman citizen, this was the most merciful, dignified day if you could die, was have your head cut off. And so, if they did or not, that's you know, you think they did. He also tells about one slave who put on his master's clothes and took his place. And the army came in and decapitated him, and his master fled. This time, by the way, during this period, Hannus Cicero was killed. And Antony commanded Cicero's head be put up on a stake in the forum. Like I said again. Because Cicero represented the old system. And Cicero was a great critic, and they knew this. They put up Cicero's head.
I'll talk about 170. Pius and Antony to join together. How would they talk in this room?
Well, they agreed. They said, look, if you'll work together, we'll work with you. We'll help you.
And they were the top?
Yeah. Really, they gave them legal respectability. In other words, when the Senate did this, they became they sort of legalized what they were going to do anyway. The legal sanction of it. You know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, the second, the great jurist, said that the purpose of law is to codify what man's going to do anyway. And so they finally, they knew they were going to do it anyway. So they thought, well, at least it'll be, well, they will try to bring some order out of chaos by making it legal. See, the Romans had a law. A man, in a time of, see, this is, I mean, Octavius, then we'll take it up from here. How could these men become dictators? See, the Romans had a law, went back to the days of the Republic. Remember they had this theory that power corrupted, therefore, you know, man would be a consul. Well, not very long. He'd be governor, but not very long. Well, the Romans had a law that in case of an immediate threat, say the army, the city is being surrounded, an immediate military threat, if they could appoint what we would call a military commander, a dictator, as a term they use, a dictator. And he would have absolute authority. Very briefly, though. By the way, he could have authority until the emergency was over. Then he could lay down all of his authority. And in other words, if the enemy, the city's falling, they realized that you might need one man to be in charge to save them. But they didn't want him in charge indefinitely. By the way, and many of them did this. The most famous is the one, was of course Cincinnatus, from Cincinnati's name. This back in the days of the Republic, he was out in the symbol of Cincinnati as the plow. He was out plowing in the field, according to the story. And Rome was beset by some enemies, and the armies were gone. They needed somebody to rally the city to the defense and save the city, so they came asking him to save it. He became the dictator. Absolute ruler of the city of Rome. He pulled together the military men, the army, you know, the military force together, saved the city. As soon as the battle was over, he laid down his powers and went back to finish the plowing. Therefore, he was highly honored. What they did was, here was the legal loophole. Things were absolutely crumbling. And you see, anything is better than anarchy. The time you have anarchy, you always usually have a dictatorship follow, because anything's better than nothing working. You don't matter realize that if you've never been through anarchy. For instance, the worst thing you can have is mob. A mob. From those who've been trained in riot control, you know, it's critical things in the world to face a mob with no control. At Kent Station, you know, these National Guardsmen were tried for shooting into the crowd. But I maintain that no juror should ever try that who has never faced a mob. Because it was absolutely no control. But a horrifying thing. The world was falling to the mobs. So what they did was they said to these fellows, we'll make you dictators to save the city. This is the legal loophole. And the problem was, they would be dictators for life. And that's really what Augustus became. He wasn't save the city and then go back to the plowing. He maintained the authority. Actually, Augustus did, he laid it down. I'll talk about that later, but this is the loophole he found in what the Senate did. And made them dictators under this legal precedent. But it was better than nothing. See, it wasn't a matter of sitting down and having a number of choices available to them. Okay, good. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
So they were sort of, this is what was going to happen, so they tried to grant legal sanctions to the major order out of it. Yes, go ahead.
Well, how long could they be in the Senate?
They would be senators for many years, but they would only serve for certain
years. What they expected. The quiz question was maybe a test. The quiz question from Section 1 will be more general than Section 2. The section we're in now, the question will be more specific because we're going into more detail. I'm going to get to many. In the Augustan age, it's very important because it will confirm the background for understanding the New Testament. By the way, maybe it's because one of my specialties is history, but a few things will enrich your preaching, fellows, any more than a knowledge of historical context. Most, I'm sad to say, that much preaching handles the New Testament material differently than given in a vacuum. So it came down from heaven out of a cloud, and so like a crystal ball, there it is, and there's no context is ever given. Even sometimes.
Our founding fathers, when they set up our country, they simply were not,
they were not revolutionary in that sense at all. Communist literature often calls this generation revolution, saying our country started revolution. And it won't believe that our founding fathers simply claimed the rights of Englishmen. Which rights were assured to them under English law? But if you don't follow me, they work from a situation that recognizes the rule of law and order, even though it was corrupt. And therefore, so really what our founding fathers did was set up an alternative form of republican government. You got that? An alternative form of rule of representative. Now, but Rome didn't have it. Rome had anarchy. The money wasn't worth anything. The army was the only, see, when you have anarchy, and when a nation comes to anarchy, the only controlling force is the military. And you see, by the way, where do you see this now? You see on the 6 o'clock news tonight.
Iran.
Everything's falling apart. Nobody can decide who's in charge. Who ends up being in charge?
The military.
Why? Because you have men who you have organization, you have a chain of command. It's the only thing left. And that's all you see with Julius Caesar and with the rise of Augustus Caesar in the case of anarchy, when nobody's in charge, the military comes to be in charge. Do you understand what's going on? It happened in our country. Exactly. It happened in South America all the time. Now, so there was this triumvirate, but the two we're talking about was Caius Octavius and Mark Antony. And they agreed to work together long enough to clean up the situation before they got around to fighting one another to see who was really going to be in charge. And so they had this great purge we talked about, where the 300 senators, about 2,000 what we would call businessmen, were put to death. And among these, the most famous one put to death, the most famous, as far as history is concerned, the most famous Roman put to death during this period was Cicero. Now, after the bloodbath in Rome, the triumvirs, Lepidus, Octavius, and Caius Octavius and Mark Antony, they set out to Macedonia and Thrace because Brutus and Cassius, the ones who had led it in the plan to assassinate Julius Caesar, they had their own armies, and they were contesting the triumvirate for the control of Rome. And they met in a famous battle here in northern Greece. And the famous Battle of Philippi, and here, where they fought among other Greeks in Macedonia. This is the area where the letter of Philippians written to, of course, with the famous scene of battle out by swamp, and the greatest historian of itself, but can't get home with that. That's okay. You shouldn't be embarrassed when you're up in our class. You're halting the progress of Christianity. And Brutus and Cassius, they were kind of in this area. They were in this area. And Antony and Caius Octavius were the elected people. They met them here, this part of the world, fought it out. This is what Brutus and Cassius did. They just were ready to fight. And the war is very simple, by the way. They collected taxes in 45 minors for 10 years of land. They sent the next 10 years of taxes to pay for the war. And they occupied Parthians for solid time. And Paul said, I'm a citizen of no mean city. What's on the city? Because they had got their full of a tax, a special tax of $9 million. That one city, fight the war, do the protection. And they sold the entire population of 4 million pounds. That means you did? They sold the entire population of 4 pounds, man, woman, and child. For slavery, for this war. And they lost anyway. 42 BC, the plain of Philippi. So how did all this come about? Mighty Rome, see, it was a chaos. Nobody was in charge. And then, what's that to say? If I'm showing Brutus and Cassius here,
Frank Philippi. They became the Roman Empire was once more united. That's ever since they had their turmoil. Once that was said, they decided they had now to go to the fight of the desert. The lepers, being in the town, he was in the North Africa, they came up to the first Mark Antony, and then they fought against each other. Interestingly enough, they were brothers in law. Mark Antony fell for the charge of Cleopatra, who had been quite a woman, one of the colonies down here in the city. And he began to have children by her. Must have been quite a woman. And to make a long story short, it was in August, sorry, September 7th, 31 B.C., famous Battle of Actium, Actium's off the coast here, off the coast of Greece. Famous Battle of Actium. This is where the Greeks were in a single battle in the history. This is where Cleopatra Octavius, the Republican and ally, I think, destroyed the combined navy of Antony and Cleopatra on a simple device and boarded them and set fire to them. Antony and Cleopatra, the combined forces, were defeated, and Cleopatra Octavius, later to be called Augustus, became the dictator, the ruler, the sole ruler of the Roman Empire. Can you tie that one more for me again? Mm-hmm. Very briefly, yes.
Before I get completely off, can we back up to Julius for you? Oh, yeah. He's the one who led the army across the
border. I think that's a story in detail. You've got to talk about that. My story is Julius Caesar. Okay, Julius is the probably the biggest spirit. Anarchy, chaos, inflation, several times. Julius Caesar, I guess. He was the most successful man, George was awarded in the military. And Julius Caesar won his daughter's war, ever since his second year of only as he died out to leave the United States, but all the officers had to be married. Anyway, and then so when Caesar came back, rather than follow the law and bring his army, he decided that somebody had to put the Roman Empire in order. Somebody had to start to bring it out. So he set himself there. He came back every time, and made himself emperor. Made himself dictator, not emperor. Got that? But for a lot. He was going to survive, and he was going to say he was going to graduate into a constitutional judge, if he was so. But his enemies, led by Rufus and Cassius, preserved the empire, at least in him, a dictator. They assassinated him. Not in personal, but they were in the dictator, and he went away. Then, and so this created more chaos. So the next few years, you had two other strongest generals. These were the men who were the heaviest and heaviest soldiers. Okay, the king. Two strongest were Mark Antony and Caius Octavius and Lepidus. Got that? And so they legitimized what they were going to do anyway. The Senate appointed them dictators. So they were charged anyway. And so they worked together until they put down the other factions led by Rufus and Cassius, the ones who were the successful people. They had Battle of Philippi. That's an answer. And Caius Octavius destroyed the force of Rufus and Cassius. Well, then, once that United Roman Empire under the conqueror, Lepidus, Caius Octavius, and Mark Antony. You with me? That he now knows, and on these three, the officials. As soon as that was done, Anthony and Caius Octavius set about to fight one another. The sole ruler, the sole citizen, and Caius Octavius won. And he later became Augustus. Now the dream of David, Caesar Augustus, for all the world to be back. Now, and it's impossible to understand the detail, but I understand something about the Augustan age. The Augustus came to be something of, and I'm going to talk about this when I talk about Augustan literature, but Augustus came to be seen as the savior of the Roman Empire. We must not think that Augustus became the ruler over a people who hated him. They welcomed him as a whole. Because, as I said yesterday, anything is better than anarchy. There was someone who was trying to
put the house in order. And Augustus, we come down around to the Augustan reforms, by the way, well, the status of the Principate. I'm proud of myself, I'm right. Because there's one of the Principate. Now, the Principate means first citizen. And Augustus was an exceedingly intelligent man. He knew that if he wore the name emperor or dictator, these early emperors were not called emperors, by the way. Later was born. He knew that if he assumed the office of dictator, that he would be assassinated. It was not that he feared for his life so much, but he knew that his government would not stand. Because Julius Caesar had himself declared the son of God, de re believes, by the Senate, and he just openly said, I'm in charge. Well, what Augustus did, and I'm oversimplifying and summarizing, but we have to do it in a class like this. What Augustus did was that there was never any question of who was in charge, but he never took the role of dictator or emperor. He created a new role. He created the role of the Principate, that is the first citizen. By that he meant I'm just a citizen. I'm just one of the crowd. I'm the first citizen. And what he did, he took the various roles. For instance, the Pontifex Maximus, which originally meant the chief bridge builder, but the Pontifex Maximus was the office, by the way, the etymology of it, was the office, the Pontifex Maximus was the office of the man who was in charge of Roman religion. And interesting enough, this title has been perpetuated in who? The Pope. The Pope is the Pontifex Maximus. But what he did, he held a number of offices, which I won't go into, but to make a long story short, to summarize what I'm saying, what Augustus did was he kept the real power in his own hands and yet created the illusion of constitutional government. The Senate functioned, he gave them a lot of lip service, a lot of talk, he gave them a lot of honors, but he made all the real decisions himself, and they became the rubber stamp. The way some fellows do the eldership. You know, you always told them they were in charge, and very bad for a preacher to tell the elders that they're in charge, really he's in charge. He knows it and they know it. It always makes for a weak church, because you can't make a fool out of a man very long. A man always knows it when you make a fool out of him. And the Senate knew they were being made fools of, they could do anything about it. He had the army. You got that? And so he preserved the illusion of constitutional government. The Senate went through the motions. They passed the rules. They had their vote. But Augustus was in charge, and everybody knew it. And they accepted this. And it's Rome, by and large, concerning the alternatives. Now, Augustus proceeded to put the empire in order. For one thing, he stopped piracy. The big thing. By the way, Mark Antony had done a lot of this. The Cilician pirates, mainly from Cilicia here, Cilician pirates for a long time, as Roman Republic crumbled, the lawless someone took over, and the Cilician pirates have dominated. First, one of the things that happened during this period of weakness was the famous revolt of Spartacus, then movie of this. Slaves revolted, the pirates took over the Mediterranean. And it's very important because this time Rome got most of the grain from Egypt. Paul was on a grain ship. He was shipwrecked and out of Egypt. And so first Mark Antony got the navy together and they stopped piracy. That was a good thing. This is one of the reasons. One of the reasons why Paul and his traveling companions and others were not told about, with perfect alacrity, with no second thought, would board a ship to go to Rome. 100 years before that, you would not have thought of it. Or 50 years before that. Why? Or you would have not even tried to travel, because the bandits would have killed you probably. So Paul goes down to Caesarea, gets on a ship, and sails to Rome. No problem. Why? Because the seas were safe. And Augustus did this. We may not like dictators. See, by the way, we like the word democracy. Don't misunderstand it, but democracy never has worked very long. In classical Greece, it didn't work.
Democracy doesn't work very well. The only time democracy works is when you have an enlightened people who have a strong moral code. You see, democracy means the people choose. If you have if the majority of people have no are ignorant, or if the majority of people are self-serving, there's no real depth of character, the people will simply choose to destroy themselves. Every democracy, listen to me, every democracy that ever stood has been voted out of existence by the people. England did it, voted themselves into a socialist state. America has not been a democracy for a long time. America is a socialist welfare state. Who gets elected? The man who promises to give the most people what they will not work for or cannot work for. You see, that's why, for instance, our founding fathers, Noah Webster was somebody, or Benjamin Franklin, they realized that democracy wasn't going to, that if a man's vote was only as good as that man. It was only as intelligent as that man was intelligent. It was only as moral as that man was moral. It was only as patriotic as that man was patriotic. And if that man was immoral, ignorant, then he would cast an immoral, ignorant vote and you would have an immoral, ignorant country. That was the reason that they set up a system of public education. And the reason that they set up the system of the separation of church and state. This is for the good of the church. Because they knew without a strong educational system, without a strong church, America would not stand. The idea wouldn't work. The idea, the American ideal, would not work. So, what I'm saying is this. The people of the Roman, we must not think of the Roman people of the Roman Empire, objected too strongly to this. Not later on they came to object and they got bad emperors, Nero, Caligula, and Tiberius and some others. But at this time, they more or less welcomed it. They had never lived under democracy, not really. Not most of the people. Not even a Republican form of democracy, but it was ruled by representative government. And what they wanted, I'll show you a perfect parallel. When Mussolini took over Italy in the 1930s, things were in chaos. The money wasn't worth anything. The school system was broken down. The public work system was broken down. And here came a dictator. And the American liberal press, every time anybody would object to a dictatorship in Italy, the standard answer was, yes, but he made the train run on time. That was the answer. They would say, yes, he's a dictator. But notice, but the thing is that the country's working now. And the slogan came to be, became a catchphrase, yes, but he made the train run on time. Say, well, that man objected to having a dictator for life in Rome. Yes, but he made the train run on time. You get the picture? So the people, they did not. They may not have been in love with the man. But for instance, talking about the Augustan Reform, now we're down to Roman numeral 2, okay? He stopped piracy. He was saying you could ship your goods again. He punished corrupt officials. He really did. He made an honest attempt to punish those who had their hand in the public till. He raided the treasury of Egypt. There was a lot of money in Egypt back in those days. About 2,000 years. He raided the treasuries of Egypt, brought the money to Rome, and reestablished, and with this gold, hard, by the way, it always takes hard gold for genuine economic reform, can't just print money. With this hard gold, he reestablished the value of money. Interest rates soared. Real estate value rose, the economy expanded. People could borrow money. They could get their business going or improve it. But the term Augustus, the etymology of this, is the Latin word augere, which means to increase. He was given this title because the empire began to grow, the economy began to expand. And by the way, this was during the youth, and all the time this was going on, Jesus was a little boy at Nazareth, the youth. This is our historical context. He limited the dole, the free handout, to 200,000 citizens in Rome. He established the first fire department in history. Rome had a bad habit of burning regularly. All the ancient cities did. He said, and it was true, he said, I found Rome a city of dried clay and left it a city of marble and brick. mainly marble. He rebuilt, he was one of the greatest builder, perhaps Hadrian was, but he beautified the city, the great building projects. And he, so he's a part of that. The ancient Rome itself was made up of the way people lived and what we would call apartment buildings. They were called insulae, I-N-S-U-L-A-E, for Latin, y'all know that. Insulae, and they were what we call apartments. And the richer you were, the lower down you were, the elevator, of course, and they had no central heating, a lot of open fires, like a charcoal burner, and had running water, depending on how fast you could run, and the upper levels, and the number one problem was that they fell down. They would just, they would crumble. The second danger was fire. And we're down to this later on, this section, the section of Rome where most of the people lived, in Nero's day burned. We call it burning of Rome in Nero's day. Deal with that in the early Christian century. But it burned down many other times before. A whole section of the city would burn. And so he established, vigilantes, when we get the word vigilante or vigilant, those who watch. He established a fire department. Those, they were on patrol, and as soon as the fire got started, they would get it put out before it burned down the whole, burned down a square mile. Which is a real problem. It's a real danger. But if we live in the third, fourth, or fifth floor, and these insulae, we get our word insulate from this, divided, like an apartment is a divided off living space, separated from another living space. It's a real danger. If you live on the third, fourth, or fifth floor, you took your life in your hands to go to sleep at night. By the way, the city, Rome always had two continuing problems. One was the smells of open sewers and public latrines. And, we have every house of every, we feel like we can't have a house unless it's got two bathrooms now. Absolutely, two bathrooms. You know, I've got four children, my absolute minimum is eight. The old hotels used to have, you get a hotel with a bath at the end of the hall, the common bath, everybody in the hotel on the floor shared it. And some ghetto apartments still have that arrangement. But in Rome, for most of where average citizens live, the only facility you had was a public latrine. Two blocks down, and you plan to hit. Anyway, the smell is terrible. Open gutters, open sewers, and the noise. In fact, the law was passed. Thus was passed the law that the carts which came into the city to bring the produce for the daily, they had to come in every night or every day to bring food to the city, could only come in at night because of terrible traffic. He did that because of the traffic. He simply couldn't get through the streets. Narrow streets. It's impossible to just get these mammoth traffic jams. So he passed this law that the produce cars from the country don't come in at night. Well, that meant you just had noise 24 hours a day. It was impossible to sleep at Rome in Rome at night. That's why the wealthy citizens would have their villas. They'd come into Rome and do business or sit in the Senate. But they didn't live there. They didn't have to. Now, there was a palatine, one of the areas where the wealthy lived, where they had their estates, but it was very common for the moderately wealthy citizens to have a villa out in the countryside where the air was fresh and it was quiet. They came into town to do business, a country home. It was almost a matter of necessity, to kind of stand it. Now, he set up a postal system. He built a vast network of roads. He built the famous Great Sewer in Rome to carry away some of the filth. It's a very big help, also the public health as well as the stench. In 15 BC, he established the national mint up in Gaul, a place called Lindum. Don't worry about that, because it was near silver. So the silver mines established now this is quite a thing. Think about this man. Think of a postal system, and a fire department, and a national mint, so that, you follow me, had official coinage. And he faced the problems of the failing Roman racial stock. Augustus believed
And I think you're probably in the main right, that Rome is not going to be preserved if they could not restore the ancient traditions of manhood and honor and courage. And he felt that the only way they were going to do this was to restore the ascendancy of the old, what he would call the old Roman stock, the best families, the aristocrats, the aristocrat means aristos in Greek means the best. The aristocrat family were the best families. And so he tried, and as I said, because of great immorality and a number of reasons, women begin to look down upon having children and the aristocratic families. And by the way, when women, it's interesting, and I'm not sure I know why, maybe somebody don't, it's not my area, but it's true, that when women in a society become people of leisure, and they become, quote, what we would call today, liberated, the more liberated they are, and the more leisure they have, the fewer children they have. For all kinds of reasons. Fewer children live. One of the reasons we know now, modern pediatrics or obstetrics, I mean, are coming around to appreciate the fact that if mothers are healthy, they tend to have babies who are healthier and survive better. The women who are weak and laid around and the slaves do all the work, their babies didn't live. And anyway, for all kinds of reasons, many of which I'm not aware of, many I don't want to go into, there was a real problem of the old Roman stock, the old aristocracy, was becoming an increasing minority. And so Augustus Caesar gave a tax incentive to have more children. To give a tax break, more children you'd have. I've heard of that, not for that reason. And if a Roman family would have many children, he would send lavish gifts to them. You know, the old aristocracy, the old nobility. They'd have a child. He'd send them a beautiful gift, maybe worth several thousand dollars, to encourage others to have children. And we're going to see later as we get to Roman literature. I'll mention it here. I want to make sure that I am going to deal with that. You've heard of Ovid, famous Roman poet, O-V-I-D, Ovid. Well, Augustus eventually exiled Ovid because Ovid was a very popular poet. And we're going to come back to this later, but I'll mention it here. He wrote a famous tour de force on, kind of parody, on how to get out of an affair. There was a song, in the 50 Ways, or whatever you love. Ovid had that first. He wrote on the art of love, but not married love. And Ovid was the avant-garde, he was the Hugh Hefner of his day, very popular. He promoted romantic love, but not married love. He wanted hanky-panky, but no kids. And so Augustus exiled him to Bulgaria. Ran the old boy out of town. Why? Well, Augustus didn't want to hear that. He can't even figure the high mortality rate, you know. He wanted the Roman families to have children. He also, Augustus, we're going to touch on this again, we talk about slavery. He limited the freeing of slaves. And by the way, see what people would do was, by the way, a high percentage of the population of Rome was slave at this time. What people would do is, they would buy a slave and they would work them until their useful years were done. They were too old or they would get sick. You know, and then here they had a slave they had to feed, but they were getting no work out of it because they were too old or they were sick or injured. So they would simply free them. And the state had to take care of them. They freed a slave, put him out in the street, and they're a free man. Obviously couldn't support himself. And the state had to support them, so Augustus put an end to that. So he said, if you work him till he's 60, you feed him till he dies.
if you work him and he gets hurt, or she gets hurt, you keep them until you, you know.
Yeah. You disagree with that?
If they're going to have slavery, that's pretty, that's a reform, isn't it? Regardless, we're going to do it that way exactly.
Suetonius, one of the two, Tacitus and Suetonius are the two primary secular historians for this period of the Caesar. You've got to watch Suetonius because he had very little good to say about anybody, any of the Caesars, the what's called the Julio-Claudian line. But he liked Augustus pretty well. So Suetonius is generally dependable. You've got to realize, though, that he had a little love for Caesars. But he talked about, he gives an account of the of what we know what Augustus looked like. Would you like to know what this man looked like?
You're going to know if you want to or not.
His body, he was, let's see, Augustus was remarkably handsome and a very graceful gait, even as an old man, but negligent of his personal appearance. He cared so little about his hair that to save time he would have two or three barbers working hurriedly on it together. And meanwhile, read or write something, whether they were giving him a haircut or a shave. He always wore so serene an expression, whether talking or in repose, that the Gallic chief once confessed to his compatriots, when granted an audience with the emperor during his passage across the Alps, I would have carried out my plan of hurling him over a cliff had not the sight of his tranquil face softened my heart, so I desisted.
The story was, whether it was true or not, this fierce Gallic chief, you know, was going to assassinate him. The Gallic didn't mean he was being assassinated. He said, my plan was to go in there and have an audience with him, his villain, and climb over the cliff. But he said, after meeting him, I just couldn't do it.
Augustus' eyes were clear and bright. He liked to believe that they shone with a sort of divine radiance.
We saw a movie one time, you know, that this Tom was one of us. He had a twinkle in his eye and moved his head.
Great chase.
Divine twinkle in his eye. I guess it like it.
It gave him profound pleasure if anyone at whom he glanced keenly dropped his head. By the way, you know, don't misunderstand. This fella, while he may not believe he was a god, he believed he was very close to it. Because he had won, he'd become the sole dictator of the Roman Empire, and he was putting it in order. And by the way, I'll come back to this perhaps later, but you see, we read about Caesar Augustus, there went out a decree for Caesar Augustus for the world to be taxed as a census. This is a part of his Augustan reform. He wanted to know how many people he had, where they were, how much tax money he could reasonably afford. If he farmed out, and he did, the right to collect taxes to the publicans, what was a fair return? He wanted to know this for two reasons. He wanted to know that he was getting all the money that he should have, and he wanted to know that people were not getting gouged. He went to the publican and found out how much money he collected. He wanted to make sure it wasn't too much, as well as make sure it wasn't too little. You got that? He was trying to run an efficient government in his historical context. Well, anyway, so he, if it pleased him, so he says, when he would stare at somebody, and they would drop their eyes. That's divine radiance. In old age, as if they were looking into the sun, and they could not bear his keen gaze. In old age, however, his left eye only had partial vision. It's pretty hard to pull it off. His teeth were small, few, and decayed. His hair yellowish and rather curly. His eyebrows met above the nose. He had ears of normal size, a Roman nose, a complexion intermediate between dark and fair. Julius Maranthus, Augustus Freeman, the recorder, makes his height 5 feet 7 inches. But this is an exaggeration, although his body and limbs so beautifully proportioned, one did not realize how small a man he was unless someone tall stood close to him. I get an impression of being taller than he really was. 5 feet 7 was pretty tall on that day, by the way. His body is said to have been marred by blemishes of various sorts, a constellation of 7 birthmarks on his chest and stomach, exactly corresponding with the Great Bear. The number of hard, dry patches, you know, like on his chest, he had these 7 birthmarks. What they did, you know, they like, now this is probably not true. See, the ancient actor believed he was born of the stars, born of the son of the heavens, divinely appointed. They probably did just match up certain freckles when they came out that way. But they also had
dry patches suggesting ringworm. It's hard to tell what was the ringworm and what was the star. But anyway, caused by this dry patch is caused by an itching of his skin and a too vigorous use of a scraper at the bath. They would have it called a different object for love. It was scraping himself. I had a big time. He had a weakness in his left hip, thigh, and leg, which occasionally gave him suspicion of a limp. But this was improved by a sand and reed treatment. I'll get that time. Sometimes the forefinger of his right hand would be so numb by cold that it could hardly serve to guide a pen, even when strengthened with a long horn finger stall. He also suffered from bladder pains. I wish I had received a couple of months he had passed